Hi, this is Roger Green, host of the Surfing the Mesh Tsunami podcast. This week, we're offering five conversations from episode 11, in which Michael Charlton joins Jorn, Louise, and me for a far-ranging conversation of recent studies and highlights. Plus, from the vault, a conversation from last year's EASL Congress wrap-up, offering some different thoughts about the role of MASH drugs as adjuvant therapies. In this initial conversation, Michael Charlton describes some ways that the presence of Rezdiffra has affected practices and procedures in his clinic and shares some of the issues he and his colleagues are discussing. The conversation basically focuses on two questions. What Michael describes as the wide latitude the FDA gives in determining who is an F2 or F3 patient, therefore eligible to receive Rezdiffra. And then at the other end, the question of futility. How do we decide when the drug is not working and the therapy needs to be stopped? Jorn Schottenberg and Louise Campbell have questions throughout. It's been a while since we did an episode with a guest where we simply talked about several issues we found important. So having Michael with us was great, and discussing these topics was fantastic. There's a lot here to think about in a lot of different topics. So just sit back, listen, learn, enjoy. And when you're done, join the dialogue in our LinkedIn discussion group. Why don't we move on to today's episode? We are fortunate to have Michael with us, and I think it's a good time for that. We've been queuing several of our episodes over the last month to the idea that Rezdiffra is here, and things are changing, and changing pretty quickly. And then, obviously, if you go over to translational medicine, for example, things are changing pretty quickly, but I'm not sure that has a lot to do with resmetirom, per se. Nonetheless, one of the things that Michael does fantastically well, maybe better than anybody else I've ever heard, is just take a big look at what's going on in MASH or MASLD in a given moment. So I'd like you to start by talking about two things. Observations you have about what you see changing or starting to change or about to change as a result of Rezdiffra being available and now actually being prescribable in the U.S. and what you see starting to take shape as a result.
Michael Charlton.
Well, it's really a momentous thing. You know, as has been alluded to, as a species, we can be felonious. We really can. We're capable of tremendously cruel and bad things. But at the high end, we're also capable of amazing things in a good way, too. And I think in the health arena, the development of a, not just first-in-class, but a drug that is shown to reverse fibrosis in a significant number of patients is now approved by the Food and Drug Administration for the most common liver disease is a really extraordinary event, and it's only very recently happened. So I think it's a tremendous milestone. Everyone in the field should be pleased for this advent. Now some of the difficult work starts. Now we have the label. So I think one of the first things that's happened to us, I just came from our metabolic liver disease clinic. And the label reads in ways that give tremendous latitude and room for interpretation so that the label reads consistent with fibrosis stage 2 to 3, and it says non-cirrhotic. So clearly not decomp cirrhosis, not F0, not F1, but consistent with F2, F3. So I think this is one of the emerging things. What exactly does that mean? It's not a cheap medicine. It costs several dollars per year. And so there will be some eyes on making sure that it doesn't go where it wasn't intended to go in terms of patients outside of that consistent with F2 to F3. So this is now a really pressing issue about what will be accepted as consistent with F2 and F3.
Jorn Schottenberg.
You're saying you come out of your fatty liver disease clinic, Michael. And I mean, my first question is, are your patients coming to you requesting the medicine? Is there a deep knowledge of the patient, or are they just up, you know, heard something on the news? And then the second step is, of course, how do you discuss this with them?
It's a mix. So we see 6 new patients a morning with this condition. We have a nutritionist, we have a hepatologist, and an endocrinologist see every patient, and then a nurse does transient elastography. We have a pretty protocol-based evaluation. And patients are at this spectrum of acceptance and awareness. So we have patients who turn up with a BMI of 48 who are pretty convinced they can do this with nutrition, exercise, and that almost never happens when you have that high and medically complicated BMI. But patients may not be there in terms of their sense of optimism or hope. They still think they can do it. So there are patients who are not coming to clinic wanting any medicine. They really want to have a diagnosis, maybe some estimate of severity, and then talk about treatment options. And they may be just ready for the diet and exercise portion of that. And we have these 6 tiers of intervention or help that we offer. The first of them, of course, that everyone gets is sitting down with a dietitian. Even if you have severe disease and a very high medically complicated BMI, people may not be ready. On the other hand, we have people with maybe F1, and they see that as terrible. And they want whatever they can that is available, whether it's resmetirom or participation in a clinical trial, things like this. So there's a whole spectrum of patient engagement with the new therapy. Some people are skeptical, some not.
Yeah, that's two important issues, because also the label reads to be administered in combination with diet and exercise, right? And I think you have a perfect setup for that according to your differentiation. Now, when you said BMI 48, I was quickly thinking there's, I believe, three doses available. And the label says below and above 100 kilograms. So, of course, that's also, I'm not sure we know too much about the use in high BMI categories yet. But I understood you that maybe that's not the best patient from the beginning anyways.
No.
Because you'd like to have them on a weight loss program maybe to start out improved. So.
Exactly. It has to be a holistic approach to this condition. And it almost never occurs in isolation. Yeah, patients have it almost minimum, a higher BMI. Most people have some other metabolic complication, whether it's hypertension, type 2 diabetes, etc. And the cornerstone that drives all of this, of course, is excess weight. And it seems that every week there's a new, maybe unexpected revelation. So, for example, who would have thought that colon cancer risks would go down by 50% in people who are on a GLP-1 receptor agonist, but that's what was shown. We're seeing cardiovascular mortality and events decrease, also cravings for alcohol. So I think managing weight, managing some of the metabolic aspects that go along with fibrosing MASH is key. So I think it's going to be really, again, a holistic approach where we're managing the driver with nutritional aspects and weight and its complications, but then also really directing therapies to the histology as well for those that need it.
Great place to open, Michael. Thank you. I believe that the assumption at time of launch was that the drug would be targeted only for patients for whom we already have record that leads us to believe that they're in the target population. We'll come back to how do you determine who's an F2 versus an F3 versus F1 and early stage cirrhosis in a minute. We had that conversation a couple of weeks ago. I'm more than happy to come back to it. How many of the patients, do you have patients who are coming into the clinic or trying to reach out to the clinic because they know they have the disease and now there's a drug they want to be treated? Or is everybody within your current roster population?
Last week I wrote 3 prescriptions. Yeah, I didn't know whether it'd be standard. I think many of us have been telling patients for the last year that we're hopeful that in 2024 there may be 1 or 2 new agents. Turns out it's 1, not 2. And that, you know, patients are expecting to have this discussion at some level. So, yeah, I think patients, they've been siloed a little bit, not to the degree that they were with Hep C and the direct-acting antivirals, where, you know, patients were really anxious to get onto non-interferon-based therapy. This is already an easy-to-take therapy, but it's not a cure. You know, that's the other thing. This is a cardiometabolic disease. We don't know how long it will be needed for. That's one of the other questions that now emerges is, what are stopping criteria? What are efficacy criteria? We don't have a Hep C PCR equivalent. We don't have an A1C. So we're going together with a group of colleagues. We're putting together an expert guidance or opinion on this currently to say what we think. It'll be a while probably before there's professional society guidelines. So people who, I know you'll be familiar with all of the names, it's not disclosed by this point, but we're trying to put together something that will help the field decide what is consistent with F2, F3, what should treatment stopping criteria be at 6 months, 12 months, et cetera, those kind of things.
Are you setting up a new panel of NITs you're testing in these patients now, because you mentioned that currently there's a lack of knowledge on treatment response? Are you expanding the type of tests you're running in patients that you're prescribing Rezdiffra?
So here's my confession. The U.S. spends 17 or 18% of its GDP on healthcare. We're part of that problem. So we have a pretty extensive panel of tests that we don't really need expanding. So when a patient first arrives, we're already getting a fiber scan before we see the patient. When I go into the room, they already have that. Fib4, of course. And they're getting an ELF score too. So we have, and then patients who are above a certain threshold for Fib4 and transient elastography will then cascade onto MRE potentially as well. So we have a lot of information at the beginning. We're not calculating things like MeFib, FAST, although we certainly easily could. We feel like we have enough with the things we just mentioned.
Louise, did you have a follow-up question, or is that the one that, or you already asked that one for you already?
Louise Campbell.
Yon asked that one for me. It was obviously about the futility, obviously getting people off medications, particularly if they get side effects, as early as possible. Because then the more we identify for futility, the better we can pick the patients coming in to use the medications, because there might be a common denominator in that population as we get further down and longer in the tooth. So he'd self-answered the question I wanted to ask.
But that's a great point. about futilities. What would be futility? So if you, let's say you have a patient who comes in with, say, 12, 13 kilopascals of liver stiffness, their FIB4 was whatever it was going in, 2.3, and they have transaminases that were twice upper limit of normal going in. Let's say that at 6 months, those things are exactly the same, maybe a little bit lower, maybe a little bit higher. Would you stop therapy then? You could argue that the patient didn't get worse. That was one of the, it wasn't a primary secondary endpoint, but one of the things that was important was how many people didn't progress. The number of non-progressors was greater on treatment too. So is that futility if there hasn't been some improvement? And VCTE doesn't move that quickly either, so it's hard to know what to make of that. And then you can say the same thing at a year. What will constitute futility at a year? They may not have improved, but perhaps they would have been worse without therapy. So these are things which for sure we're going to struggle with at any price point for resmetirom.
And now back to Roger.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. If you have any questions or comments about the content of this conversation or the entire episode, please put them in the review section of the page from which you downloaded the conversation or send an email to questions@surfingmash.com. We're working on next week's topic, but it will be at least as good as this week's, maybe even better. Until then, stay safe, surf on. We'll see you on the podcast. Bye-bye now.